And then there was the Nelson Mandela Academy for Science and Math. I don't think Mr. Mandela actually personally lent his name to it, but, you know, I guess he can go through copyright violation lawsuits if he wants to. The Mandela Academy for Science and Math signed up and collected state funds for 200 kids who just never showed up. From the $330,000 of state funds that went to the Mandela Academy, there was enough to buy a Mercedes for the principal and the vice principal. They were nice cars, but they haven't been seen lately because both guys took off having emptied the entire bank account. Despite a certain degree of public uproar, the governor of Wisconsin has steadfastly refused to require felony background checks for voucher school staff. Although, of course, they're necessary in public schools. Of course. So voucher schools have failed to a large extent. They've been struck down at the Supreme Court level in certain cases, certain versions of them. The problem being the transfer of funds from public to religious institutions. But of course, as most of you know, there are many Supreme Court appointments coming up. And we know that George Bush got away with transferring public funds to religious institutions for delivering other kinds of social services, right? By the way, I shouldn't call them religious institutions. That's way too inclusive. They're actually strictly Christian. Strictly Christian institutions can get in line for the funding to deliver social services. So states that turned it down saying, what's the point? It's only going to get overturned at the Supreme Court level anyway, and we'll have 2 or 3 years of uproar, may have that argument pulled away from them. Vouchers got rebranded as charters. And charters are being rebranded as choice. Did you follow the ballot question in Washington? Okay, there was a ballot question on the ballot about going to charter schools. I read a little bit about it online. The proponents said shouldn't be a problem. There are now 11,603 charter schools in America, and why shouldn't there be some in Washington too? More than 11,000 now. However, the public defeated the bill. Actually, they defeated it 3 times in 8 years because it was on 3 successive ballots, despite the fact that $3.9 million was donated by entrepreneurs to the Yes, Let's Have Charter Schools side. Do you know who it came from? Three big donors: Bill Gates, the Walmart family, and Gap. All those fine friends of public education, eh? They lost. A spokesperson for the losing side explained that, sadly, the union machine triumphed. Now, let me point out, $3.9 million on the Yes, Let's Have Them side, something like 580,000 registered by the coalition of unions that were opposing it. Well, the union machine triumphed, or common sense, given the very dismal record of performance of charter schools. There are now enough of them, and they're widely enough dispersed that you can actually do some comparative looking at them. It's pretty well documented, at least where data are available. But, I mean, bizarrely, despite all the language of accountability, at least half of charter schools fail to report as required for as a condition of their charter how their students are doing. And in fact, the rate of kids going in and out of charter schools is about double that of those going staying in a regular public system. Not all charter schools are religious, and some are theoretically public, but they are, as I said, all more homogeneous. Well, we've had a little experiment with charter schools in Canada, just in Alberta, where they're not doing much better. I haven't heard that Alex has moved here yet or moved to Alberta yet, but you never know. Vouchers Plus was tried by the Conservative government in Ontario as one of the planks for its re-election attempt last spring. This was more direct than giving parents a chit that they could take to a voucher school, which essentially gives the school the money, right, or take to a private school. His plan was to give a tax credit directly to a parent who would send their child to a private school. So this is Vouchers Plus. The money was going directly into parents' pockets to spend as they wanted or to top off. It turned out to be wildly unpopular, except with certain relatively small lobbies of the religious right in Ontario. And there's a real vulnerability in that province, as you can appreciate, because I can imagine that if I wanted to, I could make a pretty strong argument that if Catholic schools are fully funded, why aren't Seventh-day Adventist schools fully funded? And in fact, the UN has ruled that it is, on the face of it, discriminatory for that practice to continue. So it may well be at some point that a legal decision will force Ontario into making a choice, either getting rid of Catholic school funding or extending funding to all religious schools. I don't think that's out of the probability. The question is whether or not Ontario or any other province that still funds Catholic education will bite the bullet and realize that a necessary political compromise made sometime around 1867 is really something we have to live with forever. I mean, if we stuck with the rules of 1867, a fair proportion of the people in this room wouldn't have the vote yet. I mean, I think we can move on, right? I think there's a time at which you can say, understand how it happened, understand that it made sense then, and we do not need to perpetuate our mistakes indefinitely into the future. I'm not particularly popular in Ontario for expressing that opinion, I should point out. Anyway, talk a bit, just a little bit more about choice. Increasingly, choice works on the idea, you know, that I talked about the scarcity paradigm before. It really exploits that when there aren't enough schools to go around. And so whether it's inside or outside the public system, you've got to line up overnight if you're going to have a decent shot at having your kid in a decent school. All those other kids will have to go to all those other bad schools. You know, just it fits right into all those assumptions that are embedded in order to make this seem like it makes sense, seem like it's the only thing we can do. I have to admit, maybe it's because I'm a writer, that choice is really quite inspired rhetoric because it fits right into a market system, right? We all like choice. I mean, we all shop at those big box stores, right? So more choice must be better. Choice feeds on the dissatisfaction that I talked about, that you have to embed and attach to everything so that we constantly want to change and want more. The sad irony is that the sales job for choice suggests that the parent chooses the school. In reality, it's the other way around. The school chooses the student. In a real choice system, it's the school that gets to do the choosing. Private schools in this country can reject students on any grounds that in a general category of being not suitable. Yes, there's the potential of human rights violations. I don't think there are a lot of private schools that say, no, we won't take you, you're black. But there are lots of kind of ways around that. You know, you can do things like, oh, I don't know, be creative, charge them $30,000 annual tuition. That'll kind of help the school choose the student, won't it? Or you can build your school where there are lots of staircases. That pretty well takes care of the problem of, you know, access for students with disabilities. There are any number of ways of doing it. Or you can say, oh, you know, our school, 100% of our students want a post-secondary education. All our programs are IB programs. So the school chooses the child. That's one of the important messages that we have to get out to parents about the false promises of choice. By the way, I note that the Fraser Institute has rated BC second place. I'm sorry, Alberta got first. Second place on their Freedom of Education Index. Woohoo! They liked the way you fund private schools, and I want to be the first to congratulate you here. I'll be talking more about private school funding tomorrow morning, so I won't go into that now. But of course, applied to education, the other thing that choice does, because it follows a market model, is the bottom line mindset makes the kids who learn most easily, the kids who demand the least of the school's time and energy resources, these become the most desirable kind of student to attract to your school. Play school tycoon. Those are the kids you're going to want to come to your school. They'll bring other kids like them. I mean, if you're a used car salesman, the client who takes up your time and wants to test drive every car in the lot and shops around and drags around a blue book, you just hope he's somebody else's customer, right? You want the guy who comes in and grunts and writes a check. Not because the market is immoral, but the market is amoral. You know, water flows downhill. It's as simple as that. The market must pursue efficiency if it's driven by profit. And in the case of schools, to the extent that they are driven by their kind of version of profit, standardized test scores, you're going to end up going after a particular group of kids, and you have a huge disincentive to let somebody else teach those other kids somewhere else. So they just aren't your problem. Well, I'm worried because I'm talking as if the public system's here and a private system is over there somehow. But I started out saying the difficulty is when we really don't see the difference. Right? When we sort of, when we fail to recognize that one may be becoming the other. You know, Naomi talked about branding, and a lot of the niche schools that we've adopted in public education are really about branding. Yeah, you know, some parents put Nike on their kids and so, you know, gee, my kids are so cool, they're wearing Nike. But is it really so different from saying, my kids are so special that they're in an IB program? Or, my kids are so smart, they're in French immersion? Individual schools and boutique programs inside the public system serve some of the very same materialistic competitive goals that wearing labels offers. We've accepted a whole lot of boutiquing that sometimes serves exactly the same mindset of privatization that I already described. You know, ordinary schools are failing. Mixing everybody together is the problem. It's all about the future and all of that. Well, I won't talk more about testing. I have, in fact, practically no more time to talk at all. I want to do 3 minutes on No Child Left Behind. Can I? Okay, yeah. Okay, No Child Left Behind. Really important for us to be alert to this policy shift in the U.S., now 4 years old. Because, as I said before, we do not have a good history of resisting stuff that's flowing across the border. No Child Left Behind is the orchestrated privatization of American public schools. It's manifested in all kinds of different ways. If you are a K-3 teacher, you have two textbook series to choose from. Two across the entire country. They are scripted. You get a printout every day. This is the story, and this is the question in this order the teacher must ask. I am a primary reading teacher. I can't begin to tell you how that offends me. I can't begin to calculate how much money that's putting in the pockets of the producers of those two sets of textbooks. Now, under No Child Left Behind, Bush et al. Announced that by the year 2014, every single child in the United States would be proficient. Does anybody know the everybody's above average story? I mean, think about it. The possibility of every child being proficient is completely unrealistic. So you built in failure already, right? Now, failure currently is measured. You divide your kids up into all kinds of subgroups, 36 to 47, depending on what state you're in. You must show not just adequate yearly progress, AYP, say getting your grade 2s to the average of a grade 3 level. You have to make up some of that gap to the year 2014 where everybody's going to be perfect. If you fail on any one of those 36 or 47 indicators, you're sort of put on a watch list as a failing school. What happens? If you've got the resources, you start pulling your kids out. The good teachers in particular who have some mobility start looking around for another school, because that school's funding is tied to the success of the students. You'd think a struggling school might be given some more money. Doesn't work that way. You get less. Remember the command and control, you have to punish people who aren't doing well. That's the way it's supposed to go. That's what happens in the first year. In the second year, if you don't, if every single one of your subgroups doesn't make adequate yearly progress plus, you must pay for tutoring for every single child in that school, from Kaplan or from Sylvan or from a private testing service. Guess where the money comes from? Your Title I funds. Title I funds are allocated based on the percentage of your school population designated as poor and eligible for school lunches. So instead of school lunches, you put that money into Sylvan Learning System's pocket. If on the third year you still have not made adequate yearly progress, you can be privatized. In many states, you're now up to be turned into a charter school or taken over by chains, and schools are literally being turned over to private sector companies to be run. That's the story of No Child Left Behind. And if that sounds really, oh, by the way, 90% of the schools in Florida and 67% of the schools in California didn't make adequate yearly progress, which means 90% of the students are eligible to go to 10% of the schools that did make adequate yearly progress. How's that for creating chaos? Let's create it. John Snoblin, if he thought of that, would have done that when he was creating a crisis. John Kerry, as I said, already endorsed that idea. Just need a little more money, and No Child Left Behind will be just fine. The NEA on side. There is essentially no opposition in the U.S. to the success of No Child Left Behind. And as I said before, a good chance that George Bush will use his political capital to push that through even faster. It's not going as fast as he wants. So the right has constructed a puzzle of interlocking parts. They're hoping that some people outside the circle will be persuaded that some of the parts, like uniform curriculum or standardized testing or school choice, some people will buy the part without understanding its impact on the whole. You can't buy just part and still claim to cherish the public part of public education. Now, our dilemma as friends of public education is to accept the reality that there is nothing evil or undemocratic or even right-wing about wanting the best possible education for your child. Loving parents, including you and me, want this too. Our challenge is to demonstrate that my child's future is forever linked not just to his or her own education, but to what every other child learns as well. This is the public piece of public education. Our job is to show how the privatization puzzle fits together, how privatization both stems from and creates a culture in which we forget or deny that this is true. No battle against funding cuts or curriculum or dropping the arts or cutting teachers will succeed unless we make that argument over and over again to the new waves of parents who join the school system every year, but also to the students in those schools and to people without children as well. Schools must be public to all of us or to none of us. Your work in making this point over and over again may feel repetitive. And certainly after all this time, I'm starting to feel repetitive. But public education isn't a campaign we move on from. Because if we lose this one, I believe we lose it all. Thank you very much.